Last night we started a teenage Bible stuff, teenage Bible class, and it was an enjoyable night. We had maybe 20 teenagers there. Appreciate your prayers for that special study with the teenagers. We try to have it at a time that would accommodate maximum number, but because this flock of this fellowship is so widely dispersed over the city that it's hard to get teenagers together without having the parents having to sort of bring them to church. And if you have teenagers or you know of teenagers that would like to be in that class and they need transportation, why, we have some who have offered to help along that way. So we want to have as many as we can. Okay, the last time we met, we left off at chapter 4 of Genesis and verse 25. Chapter 4 and verse 25. And Adam knew his wife again, and she bare a son, and called his name Seth. For God, she said, hath appointed me another seed instead of Abel. The word Seth means set in the place of, and it's very obvious that Eve feels that Seth will take the place of Abel, her righteous son who had been slain by Cain. Verse 26, and to Seth, to him also there was born a son, and he called his name Enosh. And Enosh means frail one. Enosh means weak one. And it's very obvious that Seth had seen the frailty of mankind, and he named his son characteristically, but not out of frustration. He had seen the frailty of men and the sinfulness of men, but we're told immediately after that, then or at that time began men to call upon the name of the Lord or the name of Yah. And that marks a sort of a distinct act on the part of men that we'll have to look at. So, the last time we met, in the fourth chapter, we saw a delineation of the line of Cain and what type of civilization came out of the Canaanitish line. So by way of review, I've drawn a little diagram. And what we're really interested in tonight is Genesis 4, verse 25 through 5:30, which concerns itself with the Adam hyphen Seth line. Okay, now let's see if I can get this on. By way of review, we're going to draw Adam's name here in the middle, and then a line over to my left, your right, and we're going to put Cain there and summarize very quickly what we learned about the Canaanitish line last time. First of all, we learned that Cain slew his brother Abel. We'll put Abel in the middle, and Cain comes over and he wipes him out. Okay? So Cain, the first thing Cain did was, one, was reject God's way of approach. Reject God's way of approach. Now, when a human being rejects the way that God has designed that one will approach him, that means he sets up another approach to God. It's invariably it happens. You cannot turn your back on the way of the Lord without establishing another way. It may be your way, it may be another man's way, it may be a friend's influence, it may be satanic influence, but whatever happens, when you reject the way of the Lord, you set up your own way, or you go another way. So the way of Cain will be referred to. We'll mention that. In that, the mental attitude, sin patterns. He got angry, his countenance fell. He was very heatedly angry, the Hebrew text tells us. And God came and dealt with him, and instead of that helping him, he went out and he killed Cain. He premeditatedly slew his brother. So he slew. The second thing about Cain is he slew his godly brother. Okay? Now Jesus tells us that that Abel was a prophet. And most likely Abel had reaffirmed the divine viewpoint way of approach to Cain. And Cain took him out in the field and just premeditatedly killed him. Okay? He persisted, point three, in his own way. Persisted in his own way. So that in the New Testament, when the New Testament is referring to false teachers and apostates, they will be said to have gone the way of Cain. See? Jude, verse 11. The way of Cain equals a self-willed approach to God. Just like every liberal, you talk to a liberal and he'll ask you, how does one approach God? And you say, through the sacrifice of his son, the Lord Jesus Christ. And the liberal says, you don't really believe that, do you? That God would let his son die? Yeah, I believe that. I say, oh, no, God wouldn't do it that way, is their attitude. Well, the Bible insists, and Jesus insists, and the resurrection proves that that is the way God does it, see? You reject God's way, you set up your own way. That is self-willed approach to God. That's always religion. Now, following that in the text of Scripture, then, out of this these acts and attitudes of Cain, we have the Cain lineage. See? The Cain lineage or the Cain line. And what can you expect from that lineage? What type of culture? What type of a civilization? There is just enough information in the latter part of chapter 4. We'll put that down as the fourth thing that's said about Cain, the Cain lineage. This is Genesis 4. Verse 16 through 24. Number one, or letter A under that, or we won't, I'll just put little dashes. One of the things that was emphasized in the Cain lineage was culture. They developed a technocracy or a technology. They were artificers in brass. They were technicians. That meant they had the skills of metallurgy. The implications of the statements on the Cain line are just fascinating. They developed the arts and the sciences. They were skilled craftsmen. This brought about the capacity for creature needs or creature comforts. So they had a material emphasis, material priorities. Okay? Now, along with that, you also have to go along with what else comes with the sin nature. Whenever it looks like men are being successful, you had the boasting, you remember, of Lamech in that line. And with that boasting then came violence, and with the violence came disrespect for life. Remember Cain? God put a mark on Cain and said, I don't want him killed. Whatever the mark was, we don't know precisely. Maybe some type of verbal message that followed Cain wherever he went. That's most likely what it was. But God said, I will reward the person who kills Cain seven times. I'll make his punishment seven times worse than Cain's. Then Lamech comes along, which is the seventh generation from Cain, and says, I have slain a man who bruised me. I have killed a young man who gave me a stripe. And then he mocked God. He said, if Cain be avenged sevenfold, Lamech will be avenged 70 times sevenfold. So you have a disrespect for life and the concept of godlessness, a disrespect for God. All right, that is where we left off last week. Now, in contrast and comparison with that, see, we now have another lineage going to be introduced in Genesis. So over here on my right, which would be your left if you're taking notes, Eve now, we're told, in chapter 4, in verse 25, bare a son and called his name Seth. In the Hebrew, it's Sheth. Okay? Now, his name means Seth equals set in the place of. Set in the place of. And Eve tells us in the place of whom? For God, said she, hath appointed me another seed instead or in the place of Abel whom Cain slew. Hence his name means substitute. And the substitute here, of course, is for Abel. So Eve anticipates. Here's Cain off. He's gone as far as we know. And she now anticipates that God's promise will be fulfilled through Seth. And she anticipates rightly and names him accordingly. Kind of an act of faith by, my parents. They named me Charles. It means strength. My middle name is Charles. Kind of an act of faith, that skinny, scrawly, lopsided-headed baby. My head was so lopsided when I was born. It was so lopsided that my mother had to turn me over in my sleep every 15 minutes to try to get my head so it looked halfway decent. That's why I have to let my hair grow. So if I cut it short. She named her son like an act of faith. She says, maybe this is God's seed. And she was right. It was. God had given him to her in the place of Abel. And the indication of Seth's faith is manifest in verse 26. He becomes a leader when he has a son. So the second thing that's told, chapter 4, verse 26, is that unto what we need an arrow in here. We need an arrow to indicate lineage. We now have Enosh or Enoch. Enosh in the godly line. Enosh means weak one. So he is named characteristically frail one. The name indicates the weakness of mortals. You could translate the name weak mortal if you wanted to. And his parents had seen the frailty of mankind, the sinfulness that was around them. The trend toward the deluge had already begun. Eight generations removed from Noah and the great Noahic catastrophe. And the apparent sinfulness of men was already around her. Now, there are some important things expressed in the last sentence of verse 26. It reads this way in the King James. Then began men to call upon the name of the Lord. Now, the word men isn't even used in the text. The subject of that verb, the verb there is actually begun. It's a form of the verb to be in Hebrew. And it's a perfect tense. It's an impersonal verb in the perfect tense. And the subject of the verb is the infinitive. There's an infinitive construct that is the subject of that verb. The verb is really singular in its form. So that a proper translation would be this. Then, very important, that word then. It means at that time, to call upon the name of Yahweh was begun. That's a literal translation. So, let's get the translation down and then get the emphasis. This is important that this happens when Enosh is born to Seth. The latter part of verse 25 reads, then, to call upon the name of Yahweh, or Yah, whatever way you want to pronounce Jehovah. We started to spell it this way, Yahweh, was begun. That is a very, very accurate translation of that last phrase. Now, does that mean then that Adam never called upon Yahweh, or that Abel never called upon Yahweh, or that Seth never called upon Yahweh? Oh, no. This has to mean some unique identity with Yahweh, some unique association with the Lord. By the way, this will be then a clause that is repeated in the Old Testament. Abraham goes to Bethel, and Abraham built an altar at Bethel, and Abraham called upon the name of Jehovah. You'll find it repeated with the patriarchs through the Old Testament. So it's an act of worship, see? Okay, so involved, meaning, very important to the time of Seth. A, first thing we want to get out of the meaning of this is that this is a faith response. A faith response to Yahweh's name and its meaning. Now, what is the meaning of Jehovah? What makes the name Jehovah so unique? It's not Elohim they're calling upon, but Jehovah. Jehovah will consistently be, in the Old Testament, the saving, merciful God who makes promises and keeps them. He is the covenant God. So it meant that they were knowledgeable about Yahweh, and then it meant that they had proper human response to Yahweh, and they began to call upon Him in a unique way. Okay? So we want to put down B, Yahweh equals the merciful, the saving hyphen merciful God who makes promises. Now, He's self-existent. That's involved in that name. He doesn't depend on anybody for His existence, and yet that type of a God makes promises to men who do depend upon Him. See, all of that is involved. There's so much involved in the name Yahweh. It'll be used over 6,000 times in the Old Testament. Fantastic title for God. Now, the idea is, see, we're not to read into this that Adam didn't call upon the name of Yahweh, or that Eve didn't. We're not to see that others individually didn't call upon Yahweh. This is something unique, and so it's possible then that this was a collective thing, see? And so the King James then inserts the word men, M-E-N, plural. So it may have been a collective calling upon Yahweh. It may have been some initiation of collective worship. So we'll put down that possibility, initiation of collective worship. Of Yahweh. And we have to put a question mark after that because we're not sure that that's what it means, but it certainly means something unique. Now, to call upon Yahweh then would mean prayer and praise and very possible collective worship. Something new happened with the birth of Enosh among those who were believers, and that's what this little clause is pointing out, see? Though there was Cain and this antediluvian civilization that was developing in the land of Nod, and technocracy or technology was developing, and there were arts and culture among it, it was godless. You read nothing about any reference to Yah. But while that was happening, Eve and Adam had another child, and he grew up, and he had a son. And something unique happened in that group. They began to call upon the name of Yah. Okay? Now, following that then, the Holy Spirit takes an entire chapter to delineate the Seth line. Genesis chapter 5, the Seth line. Now we often call this, and it's a mis, I think it's misleading. We often call this the godly line, so that everybody reads about the Seth line, they think they were all a godly line. Well, they weren't all a godly line. There was some problems because some of them had to be wiped out in the flood. I think the best thing to call this is the lineage of the promised seed. The lineage of the promised seed. Okay. Well, I don't know quite what to try to cover here. Let's read the first part and then give you some general things about Genesis 5. We'll take some notes across the page. I don't want to have to stick that half a segment of that overhead. Let's look at verses 1 through 5. This is the book of the generations of Adam. Ah, now you have the second segment of the book. And it harks all the way back to Adam. This is the book of the generations of Adam, a statement that's repeated 10 times in the book and looks appears to be the literary divisional statement of the book. In the day that God created man, in the likeness of God made he him. Male and female created he them and blessed them and called their name dirt, Adam, in the day that they were created. And Adam lived 130 years, and he begat a son in his own likeness, after his image, and he called his name Seth. Now, the key distinction in those two verses, other than what we've learned up to this point from the early chapters of Genesis, is this. The key thought is that in the original creation, Adam and Eve were created in the likeness of God. But when Adam bears a son, the son is in the likeness and the image of Adam. There is a shift. That image bears the mark of sin and of death and decay. And so this chapter then is going to bear that out. See, what you're going to read about in this chapter are some very simple things, like verse 3. Adam lived 130 years, and he begat a son in his own likeness and in his own image, and called his name Seth. In the days of Adam after he had begotten Seth were 800 years. And he begat sons and daughters. And all the days that Adam lived were 930 years, and he died. And Seth lived 130 years and begat Enos. And Seth lived after begat Enos 807 years and begat sons and daughters. And all the days of Seth's life were 912 years, and he died. And Enos lived 90 years, and he begat Canaan. And Enos lived after he begat Canaan 815 years, and he begat sons and daughters. And all the days of Enos were 905 years, and he died. And Canaan lived 70 years and begat Mahalalel. And Canaan lived after he begat Mahalalel 840 years, and he begat sons and daughters, and all the days of Canaan were 910 years, and he died. And Mahalalel lived 65 years, and begat Jared, and Mahalalel after he begat Jared 830 years, and he begat sons and daughters, and all the days of Mahalalel were 890, and he died. That's about how we read it. We say, well, there's nothing in this chapter for crying out loud. Why would a God put something like that in the Bible for? Stupid. Just saying the same thing over again. Well, you better believe he had a purpose in putting it in. There's a contrast here between this line and the Seth line. And I don't know all that he is trying to contrast, but I know this, he's telling us some very important things that happened in these lines, and he is picking out a special son. And he's telling us that wasn't the only child they had. They had other sons and daughters, and they died. In other words, one of the repercussions of being born of Adam is that you're going to die. And somewhere between the process of being born and dying, it's pretty nice to have some kids along the way, regardless of how horrible the times are. how depraved and depressing and sinful. Pretty nice to have some kids along the way. It's possible to influence them for the Lord. And really, the important things of life are not so much all of these cultural things that we have so doggone much emphasis on, but really the simple things like being born and being born again and being married and having children. And death is important. And the wages of sin are running their course, even in this line through which Messiah will come. So I picked out three key things. There are going to be 10 antediluvian patriarchs mentioned. Okay? So in general, under chapter 5, Genesis 5, 10 antediluvian, U-V-I-A-N, patriarchs are named. Okay? And in general, number one, I have three things. A simple record is preserved. Okay. And this record, of course, would be known among men as the lineage of the promised seed. Eve was promised a seed that would bruise the head of the serpent seed. And they anticipated that, and they looked forward to it. And this is the lineage, and this was preserved in a very simple form. Okay? So that this lineage will be repeated relative to Jesus Christ, the Messiah. So, when you read the New Testament, you'll read that, well, you'll start all the way with Mary's line, and you'll work all the way back till you come to Adam. It is repeated of Christ, or of Messiah, the promised seed, in Luke chapter 3, verse 36 through 38. Okay? Secondly, the second thing we want to note about the general aspects of chapter 5. You have some things stated about every one of the patriarchs. You have, first of all, the birth. Then you have the birth of a key son. A key son, a very important son. Then, interestingly, after the naming of that son, and he may not have been the first son. For example, look at Adam. And Adam lived 130 years after the creation, and he begat a son in his own likeness after his image and called his name Seth. Was Seth his first son? No. Cain and Abel were his first sons. And there may have been other sons born in between Cain and Abel and Seth. What this derivation or this lineage is a choosing out of the seed through whom Messiah would come. So a key son is named, and then with every one it is mentioned that they had sons, key son, plus sons and daughters. Okay? Okay, and then one other thing is mentioned, death. That meant that they really were in the image of Adam. Sin had taken its effect. So that Romans 5, verses 12 through 14 is very appropriate here. By one man, sin entered into the world, and death by sin, so that death passed upon all, because all have sinned. And the idea of the verse is that all sinned in Adam, that all Homo sapiens would have taken the same course that Adam chose, were they there. The third general thing that I want to point out about the passage is that life and death, we've already mentioned this, but I want you to get it in your notes if you're taking notes. Life and death were running their course. Were running their course By divine design, God had said, I want you to replenish the earth. I want you to fill up the earth. I want you to populate. I want you to procreate. I give you the authority and the power to do it. And I want it to be fulfilled, and they were doing it. But they were also dying. The effect of sin was running its course. And we ought to have that viewpoint about ourselves. We're only here for a short time. We're going to die. Everybody's going to die. Our relatives are going to die. Our mothers and fathers are going to die. We're all going to die. And I go to visit somebody in a hospital, and maybe they're older, and told they have terminal cancer or something. I simply say, well, are you ready for this? And is it a shock to you? And are you afraid? You don't have to be, because we're all dying. I'm dying. And I may walk out of here and die before you. Who knows? Because we're all going that direction. And for a believer, he can't afford to be ignorant of death. Otherwise, you'll walk in fear all the time. Okay? So there's an emphasis in the passage. And an emphasis is upon the birth, the life process, the bearing of children, and then the death. Okay? Okay. Now, what I'd like to do in the remainder of the time is to show you some things in the passage that are not quite so obvious. And to do that, we're going to have to list the patriarchs and then make some observations. Or Enosh, Canaan, I'm going to spell it K-E-N-A-N. You can spell it whatever way you like. Mahalaleel, Mahalaleel is really proper. Jared, J-A-R-E-D. Enoch. Methuselah. Methuselah. Lamech. And Noah. Let's make sure we got them all. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. 10 generations. Now, out of Noah, we're at the end of the chapter, we have mentioned the fact that he had 3 sons, so we'll put them down under his name. Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And we even know they're mentioned that way in the book, in the Bible, at the end of the chapter, but we know Shem was not the oldest. They're mentioned that way because Shem was the most important in terms of the lineage of Messiah. Okay? Now, in the chapter, we're told the age of the patriarchs. We're told how long they lived. So, on the first column up here, I'm going to put above the names to the right, I'm going to put the name longevity. Longevity. That is their endurance. That's how long they lived before they died. Adam, we're told, lived 930 years. Seth lived 912. Enoch lived 905. Enoch 1. Kenan lived 910. Mahalalel lived 895. Jared, 962. Enoch lived 365, and then he was translated. Translated, which means he was taken to be with God, we're told, in verse 24, and Enoch walked with God, and he was not. And as he, all of a sudden, he wasn't around, is the idea. All of a sudden, he wasn't in existence as far as our eye could see. And everybody said, what happened to Enoch? And somebody said, he just disappeared. Somebody must have killed him and planted him in the field. Wasn't true at all. He was not, because God took him. He translated it. He took him to be with himself without physical death. So that his son, Methuselah, the oldest man that ever lived, actually died before his father. Lamech, 777. In other words, Methuselah's father never died. Noah, 950. Okay. So in the passage, the longevity, the age span of these are highlighted. It's a point of the passage. Very clear. It's very important. The Holy Spirit wants us to know that. Okay, we'll say some more about that afterward. The second thing I want to chart or diagram on the overhead, we're doing pretty good for squeezing it all in. I don't know if this next one's going to work that way. The second one is, I don't know if my title connotates what I want. It is the years relative to Adam. Okay? So we'll put up here their years, not their ears, years relative to Adam. Okay. Now you got to stay with me. If you get lost, slow me down. Adam will let his creation be zero, and he lives 930 years. So it's zero to 930 years, right? But when he's 130, which will be Seth's or Sheth's, 130 will be Seth's beginning point, right? And then we're told he lives 912, so add 912 to that, and he lives then to 1042. So he outlives Adam by the difference of 930 and 1042. So he knew Adam, his father, for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years, literally. Okay? Now when Seth is 105 years old, he has a son named Enoch. So you add 105 to 130 and you have the beginning of Enoch's years, 235 to 1140, which means he outlives Adam, the difference between 1140 and 930. So he knew Adam for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. You think there was any problem keeping a lineage? You think there was any problem of knowing whose father was whose father? Yeah, question? Well, we'll talk about that when we get to it. Let me try to get through this. When Enoch is 90 years old, he has a son named Cainan. So you add 90 to this, and you have 325 in relation to zero. In other words, Adam's 325 years old when Cainan is born. Get the relationship? Okay, now he lives 910 years to that, so add that to that, 1235. And he knew Adam for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. And when Cainan is 70 years old, he has a son, so add 70 to this, and Mahalaleel begins his lifespan when Adam is 395 years old. And he lives to be 895, add that to that figure, and he dies at 1290 in relationship to Adam. Adam dies at 930, see? In other words, all of these dates on the left are Adam's age when these grandsons and great-grandsons and great-great-grandsons and great-great-great-great-great-grandsons are born. Now let me show you how important that is. Let me finish the list. Jared, 460 to 1442. Enoch, 622. Adam is 622 years old when Enoch is born. Enoch lives 365 years, which, and then he doesn't die, he's translated at 987 years after Adam. Or Adam dies at 930, so 57 years after Adam died, Enoch was translated. Okay? Methuselah was born when Enoch was 65. So in the 687th year of Adam, Methuselah was born. Methuselah will live the longest of the patriarchs. He dies in 1656. Very, very near to the flood In fact, it came right out at the flood. Okay? Lamech, his son, dies before him. Lamech is born in 874 relative to Adam. In other words, Adam is still alive when the ninth generation is born. That means he had a son, grandson, great-grandson, great-great, great-great-great, great-great-great-great-great, great-great-great-great-great-great, great-great-great-great-great-great, six greats, grandson. And Lamech in the 874th year of Adam, and then he lives 770 years, 1651. If the genealogy is strict, he dies 5 years before the flood. But Methuselah is wiped out maybe in the flood, or maybe dies just before it. Okay? Noah is born after Adam dies. In other words, Adam dies. When Adam dies, Lamech is still alive, and Methuselah is still alive, and Enoch has been Adam dies before Enoch gets translated. In other words, Adam is going to die right in here, see, at 930. Okay? So, Noah did not know Adam personally, but his father very possibly did. So the figure for Adam then would be 1056, and you see Adam had died in 930. So he is actually born 126 years after Adam dies, and he will live to 2006, which means he lives into the lifespan of Abraham. If the genealogies are strict. Okay?
What do you mean by that?
That means there's no gaps in here that are left out.
Why would there be?
Well, there's another genealogy in the 11th chapter, and it has 10 names, and it ends with three sons, very similar to this. In other words, at the head of the next one will be Shem, and at the bottom will be Terah, and then three sons of Terah. And there's another genealogy in Luke, and Luke inserts a name that is not in the 11th chapter, and because Luke inserts a name, it's thought that maybe the genealogies here are not strict. I think they're pretty strict myself, but it's possible that they're not. Okay. One more list. Okay. Over here, I'm going to put New Adam. New Adam. Well, of course, we'll skip Adam. He knew himself for 930 years. But Seth knew Adam 800 years. 800 years. Enoch knew Adam 695 years. Kenan knew Adam 605 years. Mahalalel knew him 535 years. Jared knew him 470 years. Enoch knew him 300 years. Adam died before Enoch was translated. Methuselah knew Adam 243 years. Lamech knew Adam 56 years. Now we say he knew them. That presupposes that they lived in the vicinity of each other. Maybe they did not live in the vicinity, but if they didn't know him, they certainly knew about him. Which means that the way of approach to God, or evangelism, or the gospel, was propagated all through that time, because Adam very, very clearly knew the gospel and believed the gospel. See? God is protecting the way of approach so that when you get to Noah, we can say that Noah heard the message of Adam from his dad, who knew Adam for 56 years, or at least knew about him. See? Learned about Adam from his dad. And his dad's knowledge was probably firsthand. See what I'm saying? Boy, I think that's significant. By the way, Enoch is the seventh generation. Adam dies, seventh generation. And in the Cain account, there are only seven generations. And it may have been Adam who was keeping track of his son Cain and his generation. And it's very possible when he died that nobody else wanted to keep track of that ungodly line. It's very possible. Don't know that it's for sure, but it's possible. Okay? Okay, now let's, under this, make some observations. Okay? Let's observe first the age, the longevity. Observation. Number one, what about the longevity? Well, there's no reason that we should believe that it isn't true. The only records that we have of the antediluvian civilization is what's recorded in the Bible. If you take seriously what those records say, and by the way, Jesus took them seriously because he refers to Cain and to Abel. He says Cain was a prophet, or Abel was a prophet. The Bible speaks of the righteous blood of Abel crying out in the New Testament. Our Lord refers to Noah. There's clear reference in the New Testament that these are all historical incidents. So it's very obvious that Jesus took them all seriously, and you better take them seriously if you're a believer. Well, what then could account scientifically? The spiritual message of the Bible is clear. By the way, the average age of these guys is 912 years, omitting Enoch. See? So maybe we better put that down. Average age without Enoch. Enoch's still alive, so you know, if you throw him in, why, really boosts it up. Equals 912 years. Okay, how can we account for that scientifically? Can we? Yes, we can, if we take what Genesis 1 through 6 says seriously. First of all, A, the water canopy. The water canopy of 2, 5, and 6. Now remember that God separated in chapter 1, he separated the waters that were below from the waters that were above by putting an expanse, or a firmament, as the King James says, in the midst of the waters, and that is this. Was this expanse around the globe, so that there was some type of water formation above the earth. What it was precisely, we do not know. Most likely some water in a vapor form. So people who take Genesis seriously say that formed a vapor canopy around the earth, which meant, or equals, an equable. That's a two-bit word that means even. I looked it up today. I had it here in my notes, and I couldn't even remember what it was. An equable or even temperature all over planet Earth, so that buttercups could grow on the North Pole, so that when the Russians or those in the northern ice cap, they find a woolly mammoth, frozen, quick frozen, like they have. They found woolly mammoths that are quick frozen. Some of them have a paw in the air, have a leg in the air like that, and they're frozen that way. And the buttercups are still in their mouth. Where'd the buttercups come from? Another good question is, how did they get quick frozen that way? They're still there. They got all their hair on them. You can look at them. When you send me to Siberia, I'll take some slides and show them to you when I come back. Or you can read about it in Reader's Digest, and I have an article ripped out if you'd like to look at it. Where do buttercups come from? They don't have buttercups up there. You don't even see the land up there. It's always frozen. If the woolly mammoths antedate the Noahic catastrophe, it may very well be that that's an answer. That doesn't solve all the problems, how they got quick frozen and so on, but nevertheless, it's a possibility. Okay. So that, you see, you would have a temperature or an ecology. This would result in an ecology supportive. Now that's not the word I want. Supportive is not the word I want. Conducive. Conducive to life and life support systems. In other words, you would have the Earth in a hothouse situation where the temperature and humidity. Now, in my house, I just bought another humidifier. I got a humidifier in one room where I have a wood burning stove. I got a humidifier in the living room trying to keep that, and then I got a humidifier on a furnace. I still don't have enough humidity in our house. With this vapor canopy situation, you have the whole Earth in a hothouse situation. Secondly, the second thing that would amount in our point B would be enormous amounts of ozone and carbon dioxide and again elements of an ecology that would support life duratively over a long period of time and production out of the surface of the Earth over a long period of time, enormous production. That would also create another problem for us today that would destroy any potentiality of an accuracy of carbon-14 dating. Because carbon-14 dating, all radioactive dating presupposes uniformitarian norms and standards in the atmosphere. In other words, there's only a certain amount of carbon in the atmosphere. There's only a certain amount of carbon in life forms. And the decay of those life forms can be measured because there's a certain amount of carbon elements, and it can be tested by the carbon-14 method. Well, if there's more carbon in the atmosphere than the uniformitarians presuppose, if there was more at one time, then it completely destroys carbon-14 as an accurate method of dating something. We'll go through, before we're done, the radioactive methods of dating and show you how fallacious they are. The presuppositions of them are fallacious. Yes, question? Yeah, 1, 6, and 7, where you have I quoted it, the water in the midst of the waters, okay? The third element that would contribute to longevity of life is the filtering of the sun's radiations. Of the sun's radiations. Which affect two things, somatics, that's our bodies, and genetics. And the worst effect that those radiations have are on the genetics. Years ago, when I went south as a young man, I couldn't wait to get to the beach on Miami because I was a Yankee. And I just, I worked for the telephone, or not the telephone, I worked for the power company digging ditches. And all day, my shirt would be off. If I was over along the ocean at lunchtime, I just ran in the ocean, went swimming with my clothes on. And I was just burned. I was like the Shulamite woman, burnt black. And I didn't have brain one. That's the worst thing you can do. And I watched some of those southern farmers, and those southern farmers, they'd have bib overhauls on, they would have a denim shirt on, and they'd have it buttoned down, and sometimes even had long underwear on. I couldn't quite figure that out. But they'd have a denim shirt on, it'd be buttoned down here, and the denim shirt would be buttoned up here, and then they'd have a big straw hat on. They were trying to stay out of the sun. They were smart. The radiations of the sun are very, very damaging to the skin. But they're even more damaging genetically. And the mutations, it's now a proven factor that there are genetic mutations that have developed over the years and over the years and over the years that bring death upon us, or a shortened lifespan. But in the time of the antediluvian situation, that vapor canopy was a shielding mechanism, and it filtered out those harmful rays of the sun, so that longevity of life was much, much more possible than it is now. There's one other factor, and that is that the bad genetic mutations, the bad genetic mutations, had not yet had time to run their course. Now look, I'm not an authority on cancer, and I know nothing about it. I just wonder who does know anything about it. I wonder how much we really know. But I'll tell you, it wouldn't surprise me one bit if we discovered somewhere along the line that cancer is genetic, that we inherit it, that it's dormant in us, that it's there. And all it takes is the right or the unright or whatever you want to call it, circumstances for it to appear. And we're gone. That's possible. I talked to a doctor about that, and he says, hey, I believe that. He's a PhD from the University of Chicago in physiology. He says, I think that's what it is. I said, see, I'm not as dumb as I look. Pretty good idea. It's possible that it's genetic. There are a lot of things that are genetic. We inherit them. And they're bad. They're going to kill us. We're all going to die. We inherited something from Adam, didn't we? It's going to kill us eventually. Well, those mutations have not had time to run their course. When we get to the 11th chapter, after the deluge, and we go through this same rigmarole that we went through tonight, I know you'll be anticipating it with great eagerness, we'll find that the lifespan decreases to an average, can I pull it out of my head, I think 230 years. Downhill, see. No, question. Bernie, do you have a question?
Yeah. What happened to the canopy?
The flood.
The flood wiped out?
No. God used the canopy in the flood. That's partially where the waters came from for the flood. The heavens just opened up. We're going to see when we get to chapter 6, that's not the only source of water for the flood. There was surface water in the earth that was brought. The fountains of the deep were broken up. But it rained for 40 days and 40 nights. That's where the water came from. So that Peter will say that scoffers will come in the end time saying, where is the promise of his coming? For things have continued as they were from the beginning. And Peter says, of this they are willingly ignorant, that is not true. That there was a time when the earth was judged by water. And after that, the heavens that were of old are not like the heavens that are now. There was a new atmosphere after the flood. We'll look at that when we talk about the biblical reasons for a universal flood. So the canopy was one of the sources of the water for a universal flood. Okay? Now there's something, wow. Time to go home. I'd like to show you an estimate of the population. Observation, point one, what about the longevity? Two, how large the population? Very quickly, okay? I know, I realize it's late. Stay with me. Assume that Adam and Eve had six children. Now, are we assuming a lot that they had six children? Oh, no. Because they had Abel and Cain. Abel's dead. Okay. Then they had Seth. Then they had sons, plural. That's two more. Then they had daughters, plural. That's two more. That's five. Assume they had six. In other words, assume that out of them, out of the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years they married, they only had six kids. So that makes three families, right? Three boys, three girls, three families. Okay. Assume that each of their children had six kids, three families each. That means there would be nine families resulting from these, and so on. And assuming that the genealogy of Genesis 5 is strict, and assuming that the average age span, or the average generation, was 90 years, which is extremely conservative, the generation today is about 20 years. We could calculate, assuming this, we can calculate that there were 18 generations in the 1,656 years from Adam to the flood. Adam to flood, strict genealogy, 1,656 years. Divide that by 90 years per generation equals 18 generations. All right. Now, the total population then in the X generation can be calculated as equal to 2 times 3 to the X power. Here are the two people. Here are the three families that come out of the two people. And here are the generations, this power here. For example, at the end of the first generation, 2 times 3 to the first power equals 6. Okay? End of the second generation. 2 times 3 to the second power. 3 squared is 9. 2 times 9 equals 18. That's the population in the second generation. That's if only one generation is alive. Okay. At the end of the 18th generation, 2 times 3 to the 18th power equals 1,030,000,000 people.